Right on, Mark.
We kind of went back to the cheap and proud program for a little bit. Caught up with us again. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to do the intro for Beth, who's with us tonight. In the early morning hours of December 11th, 1863, the Union soldiers began to assemble the pontoon bridges to make a direct crossing into Fredericksburg, hoping speed and surprise would bring success against the entrenched Confederate forces on the other side. On December 12th, following day, 1863, Union troops crossed into Fredericksburg, and street fighting ensued. As the Confederates left the town, the Federal forces looted and vandalized what remained of the city. Yeah. Where's McEnany when you need him? Okay. to bring you the story of what happened to Fredericksburg that day, we have National Park Service Ranger, I take it, Beth Parnitsa. I had to work on that. Tonight, right here is Beth. She's a park historian at Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park, where she also supervises the Chancellorsville Battlefield Visitor Center. She's a 2011 graduate of West Virginia University. And it doesn't get much better than that. They're not good at Oklahoma, though, I can tell you that. But they're good at home. She joined the National Park Service and moved to the other Virginia to pursue her passion for Civil War history. Beth's research interests focus largely on the human aspects of war, including the looting of Fredericksburg, the movement toward hard war, the experience of battle, and early historians of the park. Let's please give a big welcome to Beth Parnitsa. Okay, we're going to do a test check with the
speaker. All right. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Is this good?
We're good.
Excellent. Great.
Okay, thank you, Beth.
Thank you. So yeah, firstly, I'd like to say thanks to all of you for not only for having me, but also for coming out to listen in. I'll also pass around a quick thank you to many of my colleagues at Fredericksburg who helped me to compile my research over the years. But without any further ado, let's get into the real topic at hand, the looting of Fredericksburg. So when we start to talk about the looting of Fredericksburg, it tends to be a bit of a controversial subject. As I heard, there were some sentiments here before, some general feelings about the looting of Fredericksburg. So to frame out our conversation tonight, I want to ask two really sort of deep and thoughtful questions, hopefully, you think so, just to kind of guide how you're thinking about what takes place in Fredericksburg in December of 1862 as we go along. So we'll be talking about what happens. There's a lot of misconceptions that range from the whole town was burned and pillaged and looted and just utterly destroyed to, you know, oh, they stole a couple things, it was no big deal. And the reality is somewhere in between, of course. But we'll talk about what happened, we'll talk about why it happened, specifically why did these Union soldiers decide to do what they did, and then a little bit of how they decided to justify it. And I already heard the snickers. So, and then a little bit of how we can better understand the battle, or not the Battle of Fredericksburg, the looting of Fredericksburg. So my two questions to think about as we go along is, firstly, when we think about victory, a lot of times we think that almost purely on the battlefield when it comes to the Civil War. A victory is, of course, when you've won the battle. But maybe you think a little more broadly and think, okay, well, there's political victories too. What other kind of victories can you win besides political and military? And then the second question would be, just based on pure human nature, what do you do when conventional means of expression or conflict resolution fail you? Besides going home to stew about it for a while, what other actions could you take? So these are things, again, to kind of frame our view of the looting of Fredericksburg. So again, what happens? We've had a brief overview that the armies are converging on Fredericksburg in December of 1862. What happens when Ambrose Burnside arrives at Fredericksburg is that he finds he cannot cross the Rappahannock River. He does not have the pontoon bridges that he ordered. They haven't arrived yet, so he instead stares down the largely undefended town of Fredericksburg for several days, which soon turn into weeks. as he's waiting for his pontoon bridges to arrive. As he's waiting for those bridges to arrive, of course, the Confederate army also arrives. So his problems multiply considerably. And when he finally has his pontoon bridges, has reformulated his plan, and is ready to move across the river, he finds that as he's laying his pontoon bridges, as his engineers are laying their pontoon bridges, that he's got a bit of a problem, because the Confederates, as you might imagine, are not so willing to just allow him to cross the river. So his engineers, as they build their bridges, are fired upon, and eventually have to resort to piling men into the pontoon boats and rowing across the river to finally take a foothold on the other side of the river at Fredericksburg, and then they fight street by street. So you've got Confederates fighting in backyards, firing out of houses, just making use of, really, the city. It's really the first urban combat that we've seen. These soldiers are not prepared for it. A lot of the Union soldiers think it's kind of a dirty way to fight. And so you can imagine that as they finally clear through the town, these guys are bitter, they're frustrated, they've been at it all day, and something very interesting happens. As the Confederates retreat back to the high ground beyond the town of Fredericksburg, the Union Army takes possession of the town and does whatever it feels like. So starting from the evening of December 11th through December 12th, and to the point that it's so bad they're trying to clear out the houses even on December 13th when the main attacks are taking place, it's hard to get these soldiers out, to get them to stop looting the town, actually. It gets that bad. So here we really see the question of what happens when you set an army loose on an unoccupied town. And there are two key factors here that I've vaguely touched on that I want to highlight. One is that the town is pretty much empty. So as Burnside is staring down the city of Fredericksburg, if you're an inhabitant of Fredericksburg, are you just going to stay and say, well, I can't wait to see what the Union Army does when they get here? Probably not. You're going to bail out. So most of the town of Fredericksburg has evacuated. They've packed up their belongings quickly and headed west or south or wherever they can find shelter. So there's one factor. There are no or very few inhabitants of the town to defend their homes. The second is that the Confederates have used the town of Fredericksburg for military purposes. They have used the backyards and the houses to defend the town. And this comes after Robert E. Lee has essentially given his word that he wasn't going to use the town for military purposes. So his strategy changes, and he uses the town to great strategic effect. It's really a brilliant move to defend the town of Fredericksburg. But in doing so, does he then sacrifice its sanctity as a civilian place? So questions to think about as we go along. But we'll get into a little bit of, hopefully, what happens. So here we have one fellow who we know is guilty of looting. His name is George Barr, and he is a surgeon with the Union Army, and those two cups, the teacup and the Staffordshire cup, are things that he took from the town of Fredericksburg. Even though he said he had very little time actually in the town, he did take these items. And these are in the park's collection. One of the more interesting facets of our park's collection is that we have a few items that were looted from the town and then sort of symbolically returned to us. But interestingly, a lot of them don't come back to us until the descendants of these soldiers decide to give them back to us. So it isn't the soldiers themselves and their guilty consciences that send them back. It's the descendants who are trying to do right for them. But it's still a bit of a touchy subject, because do you really want to think about your ancestor ransacking a town of innocent civilians and homes? No, you want to think of your ancestor as a nice person who didn't do those sort of things. So we actually have, and it's not associated with these cups, but we have a McGuffey reader that was picked up in the streets of Fredericksburg. And there's extensive documentation within the park's collection and files that McGuffey reader could not be paired with the word stolen or thieved in our exhibits, because it wasn't stolen. It was spoils of war. It was picked up. And that descendant threatened to take back the McGuffey reader if we did not use picked up in our exhibits back in the 1960s. So you can see this is a very ever-present feeling about how we want to view our ancestors and how we see the looting. Is it looting? Is it stealing? Is it thieving? The thesaurus tells me that a lot of these are very similar words, but I guess it's on how you see it. But before we get on any appearance of moral high ground, I always like to ask folks this question. This is one of my favorite topics, by the way, to speak to anyone about, so thank you for indulging me on this. But I'd like everyone in the room to raise their hand if they own themselves or if they know somebody who owns spoils of war. And I'm guilty. Yeah, right? So I'll come clean and say that my grandpa has given me things that he picked up during World War II. Picked up. Did he steal them? Depends on how you want to look at it. So it's a practice as old as time. Soldiers through all of time, you can imagine, are picking up souvenirs as they go along, and they see it as spoils of war. But Fredericksburg is still interesting to us because it is the first town, really, that is ransacked since the British burned Washington in the War of 1812. And you have a very different sort of dynamic because here you also have a town that was, up until 3 years ago, very distinctively an American town. So you have an American army coming in and raiding, ransacking, looting a town that was an American town up until very recently and very much looks like it. But so what did they do? So I've got a great quote that I think really captures the essence of the looting. So it's from a fellow named Francis Walker who composed the history of the Second Corps. And he wrote, "The writer recollects seeing one gigantic private of the Irish Brigade wearing the white satin bonnet, of some fair secesh bride, while another sported a huge scoop bonnet of the olden time. A coffee pot that would hold 10 gallons, another was staggering under a monstrous feather bed for two, while the inspector general of the corps, entering a noble house in the outskirts, found it occupied by the picket reserve, every man of whom had added to his uniform a lady's chemise, taken from the well-stored presses of this abode of luxury." So it gives you a sense of the various sort of levels of looting that are taking place in downtown Fredericksburg. So then we have the question, well, how could this happen and why did this happen? You know, these are folks who normally aren't thieves. Whatever you may think of the Yankees, most of these soldiers did not grow up stealing. So what is it about the circumstances that drives them to do this? What leads to this great breakdown of discipline? And then who is ultimately responsible? Which is a question that we as human beings really love to ask. We love to know whose fault it is and who did this, who started it. Those are questions we love. Of course, we'll also be asking whether that really matters in the end. But soldiers did go to great lengths to justify their actions, so they were really thinking about it. They were thinking about who was responsible, if it was even a question of responsibility, or is it just something that happened? So just to speak a little bit to the different varieties of looting, here we have another item from the Parks collection, really two items. These are contributed by the descendants of Charles Goddard, who was just an average private. He picked up this teacup as part of his looting escapades, and you can see in his quote here, "When I looked in my haversack for something to put the butter in, it struck me pretty forcibly that I ought to have something like a cup." So you give a mouse a cookie, right? So here we have a fellow who started out just simply wanting butter, and he ends up getting a little bit more. And so you see this actually as being fairly typical of a lot of the soldiers who participated. So think about it from the soldier's perspective. It's December, it's cold, in an unoccupied, fairly well-to-do town. As a hungry, cold soldier, what are you going to do? Well, first, you're probably going to search for some comfort. So maybe some food, some blankets, that really nice feather bed. Looks great to me. So the most frequent items that I can tell from the accounts that are taken, mattresses, butter, feather beds, tobacco, and pretty much anything food or that slightly resembles food is going to be taken, most popularly. So John Stuckenberg, member of the 145th Pennsylvania, wrote, "Fresh pork, flour, potatoes, lard, rice, beans, molasses were found in abundance, as well as an occasional duck or chicken. He said the men lived well, better perhaps than at any time since they were in service." So here we have in Fredericksburg all the treats you could ever expect. And as a soldier, this is going to seem a lot like heaven to you. And so they're pulling these feather mattresses into the streets for beds, doing really anything they can to secure their comforts. Down in the lower end of Fredericksburg, toward the city docks, if you've been to Fredericksburg, you have the Irish Brigade at that middle pontoon crossing. So Burnside crosses in three places, the river. And so the middle pontoon crossing is kind of at the lower end of town. And right there, the Irish Brigade had crossed the river, and they found, or perhaps they noticed a few days beforehand, that the Confederates had sunk very large quantities of tobacco into the Rappahannock River to prevent its capture. So what would any good soldier do? Go fish it up, right? Yeah? Go get it, right? So they start to dive in, and William McCarter from the 116th Pennsylvania claimed that he retrieved 15 boxes of good plug tobacco, sufficient to satisfy the wants of every member of our regiment and two others of the Irish Brigade. So they got a lot of tobacco out of the river, and they used pretty inventive means to get it, too. Some afterwards sold the tobacco, others kept the plugs in their pockets for later. And it was funny because some of the soldiers were right about how, you know, in the aftermath of a battle, you'd always have one or two soldiers who's going around and showing off the testament that saved his life, stopped the bullet. He said there were several plugs of tobacco that did the same trick, except the evidence quickly went up in smoke. So, but so it expands from there. And you've got a fellow, Joseph Ward here, a Pennsylvanian, who said two or three men I saw with their haversacks full of Confederate notes that were afterwards used to buy many a chicken pie or loaf of bread during our subsequent marches through Virginia. Private dwellings were entered, and at first groups would be seen examining the furniture, books, pictures, etc., others amusing themselves playing the piano, to be followed by others to carry off such things as struck their fancy, only to be dropped at the next house for something else, and finally to destroy what they could not take away. My heart was saddened by the destruction I witnessed. So you also have some different views about the looting itself. But you see in Ward's description a bit of a description of the development of the looting. So it passes from looking for money and supplies and food and comfort to people now entering these well-to-do houses. And, you know, some of these soldiers have never seen such wealth in their lives. Others are quite accustomed to it, but they're all kind of curious. You know, what do these people have? You know, what, hey, there's a piano, there's a rocking chair. I haven't been able to enjoy one of these for a long time. And then that moves to taking those possessions and saying, oh, hey, this is a great book, I bet Sister would love it. So souvenir hunting then becomes pretty rampant. And as we see here from both our surgeon and from Charles Goddard here, teacups do become popular. And you see Goddard in his quote of saying that, you know, he sort of started just by looking for the butter, and then he realized that you can't just stick butter in your haversack. You need something to put it in. So now he needed the cup. And he writes later, actually, that he realized in this letter that he could have gotten all kinds of souvenirs. It just didn't even occur to him, but he really should have. He really lamented it. But what he did do, he said he filled it with butter, the teacup. He filled it with butter and did eat butter and flapjacks until I was filled. So seems like a very good experience for Charles Goddard. So in this slide, and I realize that a lot of you can't see it, let alone reading the type. So I'll just speak very broadly. This is a map that I've started to compile. I'll admit that my work is not yet finished. That is supposed to be describing some of what is going on, basically, and how the looting is different in different sections of town. So we have, and we'll talk a little bit more about these components as we go along. But here in Lower Town, and the Irish Brigade, by the way, would have been more much further south. I've kind of cut it off to the main sections of looting and fun times in Fredericksburg. Here, down here, we've got them. We've got soldiers who actually go to trouble to put out a fire. They take souvenirs and they destroy property. That's what happens down here. Further up in the green, you've got accounts from the 15th Massachusetts. They find honey, food, feather beds, souvenirs, and property destruction. So that's what's happening a little further up in town. You've got at the upper pontoon crossing here, the kind of yellowish, beigeish color, that we've got piles of looted items at the bridges. So we'll talk more about that, but the provost guard actually does step in at some point. So you've got some discipline, and then you've got an occupied home at the very top there. You've got folks who are just staying in homes, not doing very much. So you can see that the concentration of looting and damages happens here in the center of town, and that nice long stretch is where we've got a bit of a parade going on. So we'll talk about all of these things in detail, but just to give you a sense that geographically in the city, things are spread out. So it depends on where you are a little bit as to what kind of activity you're going to be witnessing. But again, we see the looting starting to take on a life of its own. Major Henry Abbott, member of the 20th Massachusetts, the Harvard Regiment, wrote to his sister, one of my favorite quotes of all time here, "I tried to get you some memento of Fredericksburg, but got nothing better than a commonplace edition of Byron. I've got a very good edition of Plutarch's Lives for the governor. I did get a most beautiful writing desk, but it was taken away from my servant. I have two children's books for Frank and Arthur. I went into nearly every house to get some nice little silver thing for Mama and Mary Welch, but was too late. Macy got just the thing, a little bed lamp of silver." So you see, Henry Abbott's actually pretty frustrated about what he's not able to get. And you notice one of those key words in there, his servant. This is not by any means someone who needs these things. Henry Abbott, member of the Harvard Regiment, has his own servant. He doesn't need these books. He doesn't need a little silver lamp. He's doing this purely for fun, or maybe as retribution. Macy, who he's accusing of having taken just the thing before he got to it, is the colonel of the regiment. So you might think that, you know, this is being done by the common soldiers who don't know any better. No, most soldiers who were in Fredericksburg at the time were pretty guilty of this. But, yeah, aren't the officers supposed to be stopping this behavior? You would think. And the 35th Massachusetts Regimental wrote, the visitors to the main streets had returned, generally bringing some useless article which the inhabitants had not removed and which had attracted the soldier's fancy, but which he was not allowed to retain by the provost guard. Tobacco was discovered in great abundance in various shapes of pig, plug, and twist. Several had found old-fashioned calico dresses and bonnets and came back dressed in them, cutting a swell appearance and exciting much mirth. It was a sickening mixture of death and frivolity. So you see the looting again growing from just a search for comfort into something much more. But what I find interesting here is the way that this regimental history chose to frame it, by saying this is a mixture of death and frivolity. Because it really starts to get to the heart of what's going on here. This isn't soldiers necessarily just looking for a good time. Here men are standing on the brink of a major battle. They are really on the edge between life and death. If it's potentially your last night on earth in an unoccupied town, full of comforts and fun, what are you going to do? Some men spend it quietly, some men, well, put on women's dresses. So it's all in how you feel to spend your evening. But you do have, really, a lot of different reasons behind why these men do this. They are definitely going on holiday, but some are just ridding themselves of anxiety, some are just having fun. But quite a scene develops, and this is a sketch of what's happening, the sketch of the sacking of Fredericksburg. And it is looking right in the middle of, if you've been on Caroline Street in Fredericksburg, this is right down in Caroline Street. There is, in the backdrop there, the Bank of Virginia, which is today an antique store that I always know because it's got the little carousel horse in the window. So that's the same street corner today. But we have a real scene developing on Caroline Street, as you can tell from the sketch here. The First Minnesota wrote anonymously, because it's very interesting also to figure out who will actually take credit for having participated. So here's an anonymous note from the First Minnesota that wrote, "It was a rich scene. There was a dirty soldier dressed in the choicest silks, escorted by other soldiers dressed in long tailcoats and plug hats. Some were loaded down with tobacco, whiskey, wines, silver and chinaware, and the finest kind of bedclothing. One of the boys picked up a violin, and a soldier was soon found who could play it. So they took positions for a cotillion. Between sets, the ladies would sit on the curbstones and the gentlemen would do the honors. But I cannot do justice to the scene." So now we have soldiers wearing dresses. It's gotten a little out of hand. And according to another account, this time by the 19th Massachusetts, we had officers masquerading as a Mrs. Smith and a Miss Jones. When a shell broke through the house they were occupying, and he wrote, "Never did anyone get outside of a nightcap and nightgown quicker than did these officers, who were willing to be shot as men, but not as women." So we do see an interesting line here for these soldiers. They're willing to be shot, they're willing to have fun in these dresses, but they're not willing to be killed. They don't want to be known as that fellow who died wearing a dress. So then we have to ask, well, what are the larger implications of these men wearing women's dresses? What really provokes a soldier to go through and find a trunk and say, well, this is exactly what I'm going to wear tonight? So we have George Bruce, who has another fabulous account of the looting of Fredericksburg. He's, again, from the 20th Massachusetts, so he's one of Abbott's comrades. He wrote, "From a rebel stronghold, Fredericksburg had been converted into a center of loyalty. Clothed in the costumes of Virginia that were in fashion in the days of Mary Washington, a procession marched along the line with all the fun and frolic of Harlequin in his happiest mood. An old family coach, a relic of colonial days, was hitched to a mule with ears so long that they dropped on either side of his head by mere force of their weight, and driven the length of Caroline Street by a soldier in the mask of a Negro, with two representative belles of a bygone age sitting on the back seat and scattering smiles and kisses to an applauding crowd." I think this is the height of frivolity that has taken place. I think we're running out of power. But this is the height of frivolity that takes place in the streets of Fredericksburg. When it comes to this parade down this down Caroline Street, this is about the height of it. But there's a lot of pieces here in this account that are worth dissecting and better understanding. So we have representative bells of a bygone age. So we've got soldiers again dressed as ladies parading down the street. We have a soldier in the mask of a Negro. So in the midst of all of this, there's someone who's dressed up, presumably in blackface, and is driving the coach hitched to a mule down the street. And we are converting Fredericksburg from a rebel stronghold into a center of loyalty by recalling the days of Mary Washington, or by filling it with Union soldiers. I was never really sure just what made that conversion take place. So this tells us a little bit more. Besides the comedy of the scene, it reveals a little bit of the depth of the looting here. It's a search for comfort and supplies, it's a search for souvenirs, it's a way to rid anxiety. But when we think about the parade that takes place, and when we think about the language that these soldiers are using to describe what's taking place, we see that they're really mocking the Southern way of life here. They're mocking all sorts of Southern conventions in terms of wearing old costumes, in terms of dressing in blackface and parading down the street. They're really making fun of the Southern way of life. Whether they're doing it very intentionally or whether they're just having a ball and got a little carried away and thought, hey, let's mock these folks that we're about to fight, it's a good question. But it's worth thinking about. So, for example, their mockery of women in terms of their feminine garb, the outmoded feminine garb here, brings to mind, in some ways, the famous championship that many women had, which we're going to... Excellent timing. Here we go. So some of you might be familiar with this cartoon. This is of the ladies of New Orleans offering their hospitality to the occupying Union soldiers, largely by spitting straight in his face. And so women, through the duration of the war, really come to symbolize some of the staunchest feelings of Confederate morale. These are the folks who are really holding firm on the home front to the point that they show resistance in many places. They're persistently offering offense to invading armies in all sorts of towns, all the way from New Orleans to Fredericksburg, which meant that they really, in many ways, came to represent the heart of the Confederacy. So to mock Southern womanhood, or Southern history of womanhood, to mock slavery with blackface, in some ways you are mocking the Confederacy itself. So you're having fun, but you are most definitely having fun at somebody's expense. And that would be the apparent secesh occupants of the town of Fredericksburg. So with their actions, these men are really striking a blow against the Confederacy, both physically in terms of pulling the furniture and any supplies and everything out into the street, destroying things, but also in some ways morally, just by their mockery. But moving on to think about... I'm sorry, my label seems to have disappeared. This is the Bank of Virginia, which was shown in that sketch on the corner. It's probably hard to make out, but it was looking pretty damaged in that sketch. The Bank of Virginia actually gets burned out during the course of the looting. But it's interesting to note that there are some boundaries that these soldiers observe. So we think about them mocking, but they have some code of conduct going on here. It's interesting to see how they define it. So when in the course of the looting and bombardment, the Bank of Virginia catches fire, there's actually former firefighters in the Union Army who step in to put out the fire. It wasn't very effective. But they tried. And that's one of the interesting things. You know, they just sort of took up their old garb as being firefighters and did their best to save the Bank of Virginia. And even inside homes, you had soldiers who were respecting traditional boundaries as they saw fit. You have Captain John Adams, member of the 19th Massachusetts. He wrote, "I left the men downstairs while I retired. The room I selected was the chamber belonging to a young lady. Her garments were in the press, and the little finery she possessed was scattered about the room. Fearing she might return, I did not undress, but went to bed with my boots on." So you see here a soldier who's searching for comfort, while at the same time very much respecting that line of property and in some ways personal space for that young lady in that house. You see this in other places as well. So here's a soldier from the 19th Massachusetts who wrote, rich furniture became in the streets the lounging seat or couch of some tatterdemalions whom one would hardly dream were the heroes of yesterday and were to be among the heroes of the morrow. Rich carpets were cut up for blankets. Cooking stoves were carried into the streets for convenience in baking some soldier's dinner. but to the eternal honor of soldiers, for the first time in possession of a conquered city, neither child nor woman was insulted or treated with aught but chivalrous respect. So it's interesting to see that the priorities for these soldiers, or the line that they won't cross, isn't in terms of respecting personal property, but in terms of respecting the inhabitants, largely the women and children. So even as they're mocking them, they are respecting them and their boundaries. And in most cases, it's interesting to note, occupied houses were not looted. So even though I'm sure those citizens could not have given much defense to their homes, if you stayed in your home was likely to be spared. It's the unoccupied home where there's no face to look at to say, you're stealing my things, you're ruining my livelihood. That was my great-grandmother's. Those are the houses that are targeted. Why is a great question. If we want to think about these soldiers as simply having a ball, why are they having these lines? Why are they having these kind of categories? And the very simple answer is that they're still human. Much like all of us would have some sort of line of integrity that we would never cross, and then there are some lines that we will sometimes cross, so did these soldiers have those lines as well. And it's just interesting to see where those lines are. But then you might ask, well, if there is a line of morality, did anybody try to stop the looting? Because surely one good officer or a couple good officers could have at least slowed things down. And so here you have, among the better-looking generals, right, of the Union Army, Provost Marshal Marcina Patrick, who is in charge of keeping order and discipline in the army, leaves the most glorious diary account, I would say, because you can just hear in his words the utter frustration that he's experiencing. He wrote, "When I went into the town, a horrible sight presented itself. All the buildings more or less battered with shells, roofs and walls all full of holes, and the churches with their broken windows and shattered walls looking desolate enough. But this was not the worst. The soldiery were sacking the town. Every house and store was being gutted. Men with all sorts of utensils and furniture, all sorts of eatables and drinkables and wearables, were carried off, and as I found one fellow loading up a horse with an enormous load of carpeting and bedding, I ordered him to unload it, which failing to do, I gave him a cut or two with my riding whip that started him in a hurry, and then put him with my prisoners. I found in the town a most deplorable state of things, libraries, pictures, furniture, everything destroyed, and the brutal soldiery still carrying on the work." So notice how he's referring to his own army, the brutal soldiery still carrying on the work. But Patrick is going through town, and not quite single-handedly, but almost, trying to take prisoners. He, again, cuts this man with a whip. He's really trying to establish some semblance of order, but I think at some point he realizes it's a hopeless cause. But what he does do is what Henry Abbott spoke of. He establishes points at the pontoon bridge crossings. Basically, some things will not pass go here. And he establishes these huge stacks of furniture of all these people who are trying to sneak their things back across the river. And so little things like books and tobacco and food you could get away with. But the big stuff, you had to leave, and so by the time the Union Army left, there were simply these big piles of furniture left at the crossing points that Marcina Patrick and the provost guard was able to prevent from moving. But Patrick, it's worth saying, is quite a rarity. Most of the officers who are currently in the town are either establishing some small levels of protection, like you saw, you know, well, we're not going to sack this house, but we're going to take the beds and we're going to take the food. Or you've got folks like Macy and Abbott who are just saying, free-for-all, guys. Get what you can while it's here. But so then we start to think about, largely because the soldiers began to think about it, was this justified? So this is a scene just on the outskirts of town, a place called Sandy Bottom. See the results of the shelling of the town and also some of the ransacking, just in terms of this place is fairly devastated. Now, not all of Fredericksburg looked this bad, but there were definitely sections that were very heavily damaged. So was any of this justified? So you start to ask the soldiers, because they are really thinking about it, they're writing about it, they're wrestling with this. Lieutenant Henry Ropes of the 20th Massachusetts wrote, "Very simply, as the city was defended against us, of course it was given up to pillage." That's a very simple, straightforward answer. Is that acceptable? Some of you are giving me a strange sort of smile, like, of course it's not acceptable. But several soldiers are going to use this justification. So maybe that smile also means, well, of course. But Several soldiers will use this justification. The city is used for military purposes, and so under the codes of war, as many soldiers recount, it is forfeit. You have no right to claim that that town needs to be intact, right? The invading army can do whatever it wants. And remember again that Lee uses the town for military purposes. He stations his soldiers literally in those homes. But one of my favorite quotes, and I've said that a lot tonight, I apologize, but one of my other favorite quotes comes from another Massachusetts man who has a great moral compass, right? Because you might look at Fredericksburg and say, well, hey, this looks a lot like home. Remember what I said before about this is an American city 3 years ago. So Josiah Murphy goes through and says, of course, let us make a comparison. Nantucket occupies about the same area that Fredericksburg does, but the latter has more inhabitants. Now, suppose an army was about to bombard the town. The inhabitants would naturally leave in a hurry, taking but very little with them. And when the hostile troops gained the town, what a picnic would be in store for them. They would enter the houses and stores and help themselves. Well, that is just the state in which we found Fredericksburg when we entered the city, and of course the troops considered it common property and took whatever they wanted. So you might take a look at this, and at the beginning I was really excited because I was like, finally, someone has drawn the connection. This looks just like home. How can we steal from these people? Except that he makes that connection and then draws the opposite conclusion. This looks just like home, so of course we can loot it. I think that a lot of Confederates would have happily taken him up on the opposite and would have gladly ransacked Nantucket in the aftermath. But you see here that some people claim that it is right, and others that anyone else would do the same in that very situation. But the interesting commonality that you have between so many soldiers, which is fascinating to me, is that they are truly thinking about the looting. Was it right? Was it wrong? How do you justify your participation in this? Justifying is one of the things that human beings are best at. I know I'm very guilty of that. How do you justify it to yourself, but also how do you justify it to your family? Your family probably raised you in such a way that you were not supposed to steal from other people. So now as we look at it beyond realms of justification, or was it right or wrong, because 150 years later, maybe that isn't the best question to be asking, but better to understand, what is it that drove these people to take these actions? What is it that made people who were not thieves into thieves? Souvenir hunters out of average soldiers and privates and people who didn't need those souvenirs. So we have two accounts from the same regiment. So they must have been very close by in the streets of Fredericksburg, and they paint opposite pictures, which I think really helps to paint the overall view of what is happening in Fredericksburg at the time. First one's quite comical. He wrote, just about dark, one of the men of the regiment was seen to proceed rapidly up Caroline Street, by devious lines, toward the enemy's pickets, with a live goose by the leg in one hand and a black bottle by the neck in the other, in pursuit of a particularly lively pig, and singing, I dreamt I dwelt in marble halls, with the utmost power of a voice not especially melodious at any time, and not much improved by his recent potations. And then we have the absolute contrast of that, again from the 19th Massachusetts, who wrote, one poor fellow was struck by a round shot, carrying away one side of his head, scattering his brains all around. Pigs were roaming around, eating them. So here we have, from one single regiment, again that mixture of death and frivolity, all of this happening at the same time in Fredericksburg. You have dead soldiers, you have soldiers who are probably about to die and realize it, and then you have soldiers having the time of their lives. How does it all fit together? So the best account, finally the best, right? The best account that I have that spoke the most to this question is from a fellow, a private, named Roland Bowen from the 15th Massachusetts. He offered a very deceptively simple answer. He wrote to his mother, he wrote, such is war, but we stole or destroyed everything in the city. Great was the ransacking thereof. Mother, you know but very little about war. One reb was killed with a cannonball, and 3 days after, the hogs were eating up the body, and no one would take pains to drive them away. I was too busy stealing in the city. Besides, I knew the hogs wanted something to eat. Such is war. He's writing to his mother. I don't know what sort of things you all conceal from your mother, but I would never tell my mother this. But he repeats twice, such is war, in his quote. He emphasizes that his mother could not understand. that there was absolutely no way she would understand how her son would not drive the pigs away from the dead body of a soldier. How he is stealing from the city. He's too busy stealing to protect what we would see as basic human dignity. Because such is war. War, inevitably, is changing these men from the people that their mothers used to know into very, very different people, placing them in circumstances that their families would never have imagined they would be in. I'm sure his mother never said, don't steal from an unoccupied town when you're in the army. And in turn, they changed the war themselves. So these soldiers, through having fun, being entertaining, and reckless abandon, strike a bit of a blow to the Confederacy, even if it seems like a low blow. So who's responsible for these soldiers being in Fredericksburg? Who's responsible for them looting? There's many answers, but what would be their answer? Why am I here instead of Nantucket? And the soldier's answer would be, Fredericksburg is a secession town. The reality is maybe a little different. There was actually a large unionist movement in the area, but Fredericksburg did vote, that in that general area, did vote for secession. It's a secession town. And the reality in a civil war, in our civil war at least, is that you have two democracies at war. Do the leanings of that town matter? If those citizens are voting for secession, if they're voting for the war, if they're supporting the war, if their sons and brothers and fathers have all gone off to war, whose fault is it that those soldiers are here in the first place? According to the Union soldiers, it's a war of democracies. It's this town's fault. And I might not win on the battlefield, but I can do some damage to this town. And I can enjoy myself while I'm at it. But conversely, the families deserve to lose everything that they had in this world for a cause that they may or may not have supported. There's no right answer here. And that's the problem. So what the looting of Fredericksburg ultimately is, at least to me, is simply a reminder of the high stakes and the core issues at the very heart of our Civil War. How do people react in very difficult circumstances? Why are they here? Why are they fighting in the first place? The cause of the Fredericksburg sufferers in the end, and that actually became a term, the Fredericksburg sufferers, becomes a rallying point for the Confederacy in the end. Pulls in over $20,000 in relief to help rebuild the town and to help the families make it through the winter. But in this, again, the Union soldiers are taking steps toward a larger cause. They're changing society. They're changing the way that the war is prosecuted. We usually don't think of hard war as coming to the Civil War until much later on. This is still in an era where we're officially protecting private property. Marcena Patrick sure is, but maybe nobody else is. But this ultimately leads us to question the war's conduct, the true nature of relations between the Union and Confederacy at this balancing point, at this very shifting point in the war, and leads us to an awful lot of questions about human nature, especially when nobody's looking. So, with that, I'm going to say thanks again for having me to speak, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions you all have. Thank you.
Just have a question, you know, that what in the minds of the soldiers, let's say, would precipitate this would be the fact that the town was used by Confederate soldiers, you know, for the hiding positions, the sniping positions, that kind of thing, to hold off the progress of them coming across the river and then attacking Lee's fortified position.
Yes.
When you think about it, the success or lack of success thereof, and given the overwhelming advantage of geography, that Lee found himself with, was anything gained by delaying them a day?
Okay, so that's an excellent question. Yeah, when you start to talk about, you mean delaying the Union Army.
Right, I mean, if Lee had not defended the town, of course one would ask, would they have looted it anyway?
Of course.
You know, and we're protecting the town, perhaps, but in the larger sense of a military thing, and of course they're using that as excuse, hey, you use it as a military advantage, was there any advantage to it at all? I mean, the day seemed to have not made much difference in the outcome.
So that's a fabulous question, and that has to do a little more with Robert E. Lee's strategic plan for the Battle of Fredericksburg. One of the beautiful things about Ambrose Burnside's plan to cross the river right in town of Fredericksburg is that it's absolutely ridiculous. There are Confederate soldiers watching every stretch of the river that you could possibly conceive of crossing. And so Burnside justifies crossing in the town of Fredericksburg because he thinks the enemy will be more surprised by a crossing immediately in their front than anywhere else along the river. Why would they be more surprised? Because why on earth would you cross the river right in the middle, in the very heart of the Confederate line?
Stupid, because they'll never suspect that.
Right, they will never suspect that. So Burnside does decide to cross there, but the key is that Robert E. Lee's army is not concentrated yet. It is all in that area, but it's all strung out beyond the town itself, because Lee doesn't know exactly where Burnside is planning to cross or when. Not until they hear the pontoon boat splashing in the water starting around 1 o'clock in the morning on December 11th. So Lee specifically gives orders to his commanders in the town that he needs warning and he needs time. And they give him it both. So they fire a cannon to show that they know that the Union Army is crossing, that it has started and where. And so Lee then immediately begins to concentrate his army, but concentrating your army takes time. And so they buy him time. You know, Heber's probably hoping for a couple of hours, and William Barksdale's defense of the town gives him an entire day. So that by the time Burnside is able to cross and attack, he's had 2 days to prepare.
Right, and in a way, he waits another day almost.
Right, because by the end of the day, it's dark by the time Burnside's able to get his lead units to gain the town. Mm-hmm. So he spends most of the 12th filing more men across the pontoon boats, or pontoon bridges, just to get into the town. And then to set up to attack. And now, the Confederates had a lot of time to prepare the battlefield, and they had been very specific about, you know, distances and everything about when it's best to fire. But this simply gave Lee the time to concentrate his forces.
Mostly probably bringing up Jackson's troops, really, out at that end.
Yeah, and just kind of gathering it, right, because otherwise the army stretched north to the river. So.
Dan?
I just wanted to say and see what you think about it. Is like I've read about this, and I've always believed that you know, these soldiers aren't U.S. federal soldiers. They see the Confederate soldiers using these houses as cover. They see their fellow soldiers getting shot down. There's a bit of rage and anger involved. And what would they do in any other battle? There's numerous accounts of soldiers on both sides at various battles using structures for, you know, to shoot out of. What do they do with those houses? They destroy the houses. They shell the houses or they burn the houses. In this case, it's more of a concentrated area, and that's, I just wanted to see what you thought about that, because I've always believed that this was just like an anger, rage, you know, multiplied by 100 or however, pick your number, how many times over, and concentrated area, and then it just kind of escalated from that point, out of that anger.
Yeah, so then the question to rephrase is basically, was this simply the outpouring of rage from these soldiers who had fought street to street and house to house? And I think that's an excellent point. And one of the thoughts that I've been working on lately, a friend actually suggested this to me, and as part of why I've been mapping it out is to figure out, okay, where are the patterns, who's doing what, who's most responsible for which actions? Because it really, in some cases, it is rage that boils over into a party, which is weird, but in human nature, I can see that happening. And it is, for the most part, the regiments that are most heavily involved in, from what I can tell so far, the regiments most heavily involved in the street fighting, namely the 19th Massachusetts, the 20th Massachusetts, these are some of the units that are participating most heavily in the violent looting. And you've got other units like the Irish Brigade that didn't have it so bad, or some of these other units that are sort of just kind of casually getting their comforts. And, you know, it isn't that kind of vengeance.
It just kind of spreads. It kind of emanates from the...
Right, and certainly others are going to join in because, right, hey, this looks like a good time. But, yeah, you see some of the greatest perpetrators are the ones who were fighting street by street. So, yeah, you could think... I think that's a totally logical conclusion to draw, is that it is direct result.
But by contrast,
yeah,
in Northern Virginia, if it was a secessionist house during the occupation, it would go ahead and strip it out. And so there was hardly very few mansions or houses in the Falls Church, Arlington, and Fairfax County that weren't stripped by Union soldiers. They weren't used as defensive structures. It wasn't raised. It was, hey, this is free.
That's why I begged the question, would it have mattered of what they would have done.
Right, and that's a great question. Are they just using it for justification? Just to totally contradict myself and say, yeah, except that to some degree I'm not sure they knew as well in the town of Fredericksburg which houses were secesh-leaning and which ones were not, since they're all unoccupied.
But, thank you. First of all, Beth, you did a fabulous job. Thank you so much for bringing to life the humanness of this set of days here. I have a comment and a question. My first comment is, you know, some of this kind of behavior and destruction is biblical. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it is time out of mind, yeah.
In, you know, things out of the Old Testament, so it's really not new stuff. I'm wondering if along your journey here and doing your research, did you check in with some psychologists who were really kind of immersed in the research of the behavior that happens in war and what is that all about? Because some of this to me sort of feels like the insanity of chaos, of death, and I think you did a lovely job kind of getting us there, but almost a bizarre kind of comic relief, especially with the dressing and the silliness, and as you said, knowing within a day or two that they could no longer possibly be alive. So were you able to check in with any?
You know, I haven't consulted a psychologist or psychiatrist, although that would be fascinating, I think, to do.
So,
I would like to. But I can say that there are, I really can't remember the sources. I'll have to check my file. But I did read a book that was a glorious examination of sort of the very macabre sense of humor, or maybe it was an article, that develops in the army, as in the Civil War armies, you know, as they're constantly confronted with death and very violent death and just how terrible it gets, and then how it kind of ingrains in the soldiers, and then how that plays out in terms, because you see, you know, in the lead up to battle a lot, I mean, especially I've read a ton of accounts before Spotsylvania Courthouse, these soldiers are laughing, and they're laughing about ridiculous and strange things that most of us would not find funny at that time, but because they are on the verge of death and they know it, there is a sort of other sense of fun and other sense of, you know, that just develops in the army, and I think it is certainly a mentality that develops because of their experiences. But yeah, I'd be interested to quantify it from a psychiatry perspective. So,
One of the things is that from the beginning of the war, the North is always referring to the secessionists as traitors, and they come from English history and the knowledge of the English Civil War, where anybody who was a traitor had everything confiscated. It wasn't just that they forfeited their lives, they forfeited their property, their titles, and everything. So, having been bombarded by propaganda and newspapers and everything that these are traitors, it doesn't strike me as so unusual that they would do it. And remember, although maybe this is the first great instance, you get to Gettysburg and the Confederate cavalry is doing the same thing up in there. They say, well, $365,000 or we burn the town. They didn't come up with the money, they burned the town. They get to Carlisle, Carlisle refuses to surrender. They bombard the town and they burn not just the barracks, the military barracks, but the rest of the town. So it escalates, of course.
Yeah, and you see that as time goes on, you know, things escalate.
To bring in a later war and maybe even a stranger occurrence. I just got through reading a diary from a French soldier in the First World War. And he talks about going into French towns. I mean, there's no enemy of mine. He's in a French town. And, you know, they steal eggs, they steal chickens, they don't have a place to sleep, they steal furniture. I mean, there's just sort of a fundamental thing.
Yeah.
I
can
say this, but if you leave troops alone, they're like kids. They're going to do something.
Well,
it's really up to their officers to control them.
Well, and your principles don't keep you warm or fed. So, much like a chicken in a feather bed do.
E.B.? That was a great lead in to my comment that you look at the photographs and see all the facial hair. These guys look old, but they're not.
No.
Is 90% of this army or these armies are under 25 years old. So, yeah.
They're the worst.
They are kids. A lot of them are kids.
Nancy?
I want to add to that, and I actually saw a screening of a
new movie, a documentary by Rick Burns called Debt of Honor about disabled veterans throughout the war, starting with the Red War, going up to modern day Iraq and Afghanistan. To me, it seems like a lot of these soldiers are getting shell-shocked or PTSD, and their reaction to all this horror that they're witnessing is to go the other way, the other extreme, and do something ridiculous just to get the stress off of them.
Oh, yeah, and you see, I mean, there's a one of the more famous quotes, which I didn't read today, but is just to say that these soldiers are ridding themselves of all anxiety by plunging into the boisterous sport. And that, in many ways, yeah, they are taking an otherwise entirely stressful situation and they are turning it on its head. And, yeah, you can just imagine, I mean, this could be their opportunity to forget about the war for a little while. I mean, certainly they're in the middle of the town and in the middle of the war and they're stealing things and they can't entirely forget about why they're there. But maybe to have just a little bit of fun, some glimmer of pleasantry in the midst of a great terror.
They can express themselves in letters to home, which maybe a few do, but a lot of them after the war didn't talk about that. They kept it themselves.
Just like today.
Yes.
WW2 and all that. Dale?
Now, how much would you say, is it who the Confederate defenders raised? Because this is Barksdale. If this had been in South Carolina, it would probably been even worse. But you read in the attitudes about this time of the war, about the punishment to certain states and territories, that they say these people were the real keys of it. So do you see any of that in this?
So the question is basically, is there any additional animosity based on who's defending the town?
Animosity, because if you go back to Sherman, we're going to South Carolina to punish.
Because it's the heart of secession. Yeah, not that I've seen, and I think that most of the notations about the secesh troops or not the secesh notations are mostly with regard to the town. And to how the town deserves it, not so much that, you know, it's because those troops did it as opposed to other troops. It's, I think that who they were fighting was less material than where they were in what I've read.
Bob? Did any of the town residents file claims with the federal government after the war for the damages?
Not that I have seen. I haven't seen any claims for the damages.
The 14th Amendment would have just nullified that. No, really, seriously. In fact, they would not even allow the former Confederate states, once they became, to even pay people back.
Well, and I think it would have been it would have been hard to justify that these were Unionist folks.
That was burning the, I don't know if it was the Union or Confederates, forgot the seats and burned the seats for firewood.
For firewood. Mm-hmm.
But the federal government paid them for $750.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. An unusual act because, you know, the old fellow, the freedman down there, the freedman house in Manassas on the battlefield?
Yeah.
And of course, he was, he was a freed guy. He was not for the Confederacy or anything like that. And he had to go, it went to the Supreme Court finally. And he finally did decide in his favor, but it was like one of the rare cases. Because he happened to be in Virginia, and of course, as Lee once said, when you allow an invading army in, it's going to matter what side you're on. They're just going to take everything. That's why he didn't want to open his borders to Virginia when they said, you have to open the borders and let us go down to punish them cotton states that seceded. That's why Virginia seceded.
Okay, two more questions.
I don't know whether the legalisms would have stopped these people, but technically, I don't think any of this was against the law. General Order 100... Lieber law.
Lieber's code, yeah.
Didn't come in until 1863, and this was 1862. So, again, there's no law against what they're doing.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, so the point was made that there's no hard and fast law that says you can't do this. I think that general order and discipline in the army would have ruled that you can't do this, but I think that it is interesting to note that I have not been able to find a single court-martial from the looting, despite Patrick's collection of prisoners and despite you know, everything else that's going on, I mean, you've got people admitting to it. It wouldn't be hard to figure out who'd taken something from Fredericksburg. Just look for the fine china. And, but there isn't a single court-martial related to it.
Last question, Janae?
Not as much as I
for a ride home, please do so now.
Can we wait till
if you need to apply for a ride home, please go to the checkout desk now.
Okay. I think you do have an interesting comment. When you were telling me that it was the Massachusetts 19th and 20th that were the main ones, I couldn't help but think, because of course I looked it up, and of course you're right, it was made up of those Harvard idealist officers.
Right, the cream of the crop.
And what was Boston known for? That was the hotbed for the anti-slavery movement. That was the hotbed of where you had all the abolitionist newspapers. So you have these very idealistic boys that had been schooled in this. And then keep in mind, it was the 6th Massachusetts that was attacked when they came into Baltimore at the very beginning of the Civil War. Remember, it's the 6th Massachusetts that come and down. So that's their comrades that were attacked by the city of Baltimore. We call them the Pratt Riots today. And so here, a year later, it's kind of like payback time. We now get a chance to demolish some of what they have done to us. So I think there's some real important issues of having to be with this Massachusetts unit.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to thank everybody for coming tonight. Really appreciate it. And one more hand of applause. Great job.
Thank you.
And you were the first one to ever use it.
Excellent.
Thank you so much. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. This was fabulous.
You guys are great too.
You guys, you know, you have enthusiasm. You have lots of fun.
This is super. It's a vibrant group, as you can tell. They're learning.
Yeah.
They fit in perfectly. This is a great topic.
I get a beer.